First, one sentence about que or tu, because otherwise I forget that. The solution to this riddle is very simple. Before 19, roughly 38, 39, he signed himself Chen Yin Ke. And at some point in time, he must have realized that tu may be the right pronunciation. Then he switched. So all his students from the 40s confirmed that he insisted on being Chen Yin Ke. But he signed with Chen Yin Ke until I have the last article I have with Ke in it is from 38. So there must have been some kind of realization in the late 30s. In fact, I think it's utterly unimportant, but it's very important in the Chinese academic context. So I'm always facing this question whenever I give a talk. The first question is it Ke or is it Chu? First, starting this presentation today, I'd like to point out why I picked that topic, and it's a way actually of expressing my gratitude to the organizers of this consortium, because it's a wonderful opportunity to have a time off, what a nice way of phrasing it, have a time off, a research leave. We have to leave to do research and focus on things that we actually can't do in our daily routines at university. So thanks to the organizers and the directors of the consortium, it's a wonderful opportunity. And so the talk is about, in a way, about the question of time and the lack thereof in our highly efficient times. And at the same time, there's also a much more direct link, because the core theme of the consortium is prognostication. And this is not only, but particularly after the rise of progressive views of history, closely linked, of course, to the question of the nature of history. So depending on what kind of view of history we have, we will have a different attitude towards whether we can prognosticate things. Now, the first question that might pop up in our minds, why should we actually bother to be interested in a modern Chinese critique of progressivism? Here, just a short the structure of my talk. I will first say a few things about the background of the presentation, then about the link between modernity and history, the reception of modern Western views of history, and then the critique of progressivism, and in the end, a few remarks about the historical relevance and maybe the contemporary relevance of this topic. Now, the reason why we might think this is an interesting topic are manifold. The first and most unimportant one is it hasn't been well researched. It's a gap. The gap argument is always weak, but it's still an argument. We have been focusing in Western research on modern Chinese history, especially modern Chinese intellectual history, very much on the progressive people, on those who emphasized enlightenment and who received and welcomed Western ideas. For whatever reason, we have been focusing on those. I think it's quite obvious that we think these are the people of the future. There's another reason which I think is more important, and that is that in the last 20, 25 years, we are observing some, at least seemingly fundamental shifts in Chinese intellectual, cultural, and application also political landscape. In the early 90s, after the Tiananmen incident, we have a far-reaching reconsideration of what is called the paradigm of revolution. So Li Zihou's Gaobyou Geiming is one paradigmatic publication in that context, that people start to doubt whether the dominant way of looking at the history of the 20th century as a history of consecutive revolutions is actually the right way of reflecting on Chinese history. So that's just one example. Another example is then in the period after 93, especially 94, is the Guoxiu, the Xing Guoxiu, the new national studies, which is, to be sure, a very heterogeneous phenomenon. There are all kinds of people engaging in Xing Guoxiu. One of the reasons, because there are funds to apply for. The other is there are various ways of appropriating the so-called tradition to make contemporary political or cultural claims. And of course, there's also parallel part of the new Guoxiu, the government increasing emphasis on Chinese tradition, a term that is vague on purpose, and very often then also linked to catchphrases like harmony and other words. And third, especially since the beginning of the 21st century, but actually already for those who have paid attention that way before, we observed in the last two decades an astonishing rise or return or revival of seemingly traditional spiritual and religious cults and movements. Of course, this return of religion in modern China, in contemporary China, is a very complex phenomenon with all kinds of motivations behind it and all kinds of forms of organization and goals. But it's definitely part of this larger topography of reassessing what has been happening between, let's say, the reforms of 1898 and the events of 1989 in these roughly 100 years, and the by and large negative evaluation of Chinese tradition as being, let's say, a hindrance to modernization, being standing in the way of modernization, that was dominating the political and large parts of the intellectual discourse, has been under scrutiny since then. So these are all reasons that are linked to attempts to come to a new understanding of modern Chinese history, especially of modern Chinese intellectual and cultural history. But there are also reasons of a more general nature that are not linked to, these are the two aspects, three aspects. They are more linked to, let's say, general considerations and reflections on the question of history. The first is, if Karl Löwitz or William Galois and others are right, then we have to assume that views of time and history, as well as modes of historiography, of writing history, have their roots in religious and philosophical traditions. And of course we observe in the early 20th century in China an intermingling of Chinese and Western elements views of history. And for example, with Yan Fu, we have an adoption of evolutionism, of social Darwinism. At the same time, we have a very strong insertion of an emphasis on human agency, which is absent in Darwin's evolutionism. And in the case of Mao Zedong, we have a very specific view of contradictions and how they drive history in a way very different from Hegel's understanding of dialectics. So we have a mingling of Chinese and Western elements ever since the Chinese world got in touch with modern evolutionary views. But the cases of resistance against these modern views of history are particularly interesting if you want to find out in what way pre-modern Chinese traditions of thinking about history and about the writing of history might have influenced only by being an object of rejection, if only by that, of how they might have influenced the development of modern Chinese attitudes towards history. So we need to look at this background and we need to find out whether or not these arguments brought forward by Löwitz and Galois and others can be made fruitful, can be used fruitfully in the context of thinking about modern Chinese attitudes towards time and history. And yet another aspect I'd like to mention here shortly is that of course these, and I'm an historian of ideas, and that's pretty obvious, but still, especially because of that maybe, we have to think about how these concepts, modern concepts of time and history as they developed in the West and how they traveled to China, how they are linked to, well, let's call it modes of production and social organization. So is the progressive view of history that has dominated much of the 19th century and parts of the 20th century in the West, how is that linked structurally to, let's say, capitalism or socialism? What's the role of the concept of abstract time in the productive process? And how might certain views of history be a reflection of or an idea influence, exerting influence on these economic and social structures? I think it's quite obvious given the scope of these questions that I won't be able to go into all of them, but I want to just kind of provide an outline of what my frame of questions I want to address in the larger monograph, which will be called, work entitled something like that, History and Ethics, Chinese Conservative Reflections on Modernity. Now, what are the a bit more concrete questions I will address in my presentation today? The first one is, of course, what forms of critique do we encounter? How do they express their critique? Are these journal publications, monographs, And do they hide it, conceal that critique, or is it open? How do they come to that point? The whole, let's say, outer framework. Then what views of time and history are being expressed? And what sort of knowledge of the future might be the outcome of this use of history at time? Then are these, and if yes, how are these links, these views linked to plans, ideas, blueprints for society and economy? And last but not least, but this is something I'm only be able to hint at, is what's the relevance of these people who have, that's something I can say at the very beginning, have been utterly marginal in modern Chinese history with their ideas. What's the relevance of these people for China nowadays? Now, before we move into modern Chinese history of the reception of views of history, I think I have to say a few words about what I mean by these terms, because terms like progressivism and modernity, progress, always trigger huge misunderstandings because they don't have a clear-cut definition that can be applied to ideas, concepts of modernity, or the so-called historical reality of modernity. And these are different things. We have to keep them separate. I'm talking about concepts of progress, progressivism, and modernity. Now, when we talk about modernity, there are many aspects that come to our minds, but definitely one very important aspect of the modern era is a certain concept of time. Now, time is abstract, it's quantifiable, it's being used to calculate economic and social processes. Time is money, is an expression that expresses this perfectly. Time is money, time is being used to calculate the value of products, time is being used to organize our lives in ways that hadn't been the case before. And because it's abstract and no longer tied to, let's say, seasonal changes, it is something that can establish a criteria for comparison beyond climate and the agricultural rhythm of life. And this abstract notion of time and the quantifiable notion of time, of course, is closely linked to modern development of modern science, but also certain forms of organizing the economy, normally referred to as capitalism, of which I take socialism to be a certain variant. And it's closely linked also, that's not mentioned here in the list, to certain ways of organizing society. So we have a rational society. We have a society that's increasingly emphasizing professionalization and differentiation of different social fields and social areas. All these aspects that we normally associate with modernity and the rational side of modernity are also linked to this understanding of an abstract framework of time. And then that leads us to the next thing that is important for my presentation today, that is a certain view of history, and I emphasize view. It's not about the actual historical process, but it's how we understand this process. And in large parts of 19th century, early 20th century Western history, but also Chinese history, then in the 20th century, we think of history as a linear process that is law-like, and that more often than not is aiming towards an aim, towards a goal at the end that is then the final stage of history. So it's a teleological view of history, a teleological view of progress. And that, of course, can be traced back to 15th, 16th, 16th, 17th century developments, but it culminates in what Koselleck has called history as the collectif singular. History is a capital H. It's a singular process, it's a unified structured process. It's no longer histories, stories to be told about the past from varying perspectives, mostly for purposes of moral education, or politically education, but it's an autonomous, singular, directed process that is happening beyond us, detached from us. We are being drawn to that, we find ourselves in that process, we have to cope with it, but it's nothing that is under our control. So we have, coming with this singular history with a capital H, we have a dramatic reduction of human agency in that process, although not in all cases exclusion, but a dramatic reduction in comparison to stories being told before. And we have a process that's not concerned with individual particular fates. It's not about certain individuals. It's not about certain moral examples or about certain politicians. It's about long-term processes of a economic and political nature. Now, this is history as a modern progressive concept, and it's quite distinct from what we had before in the West, the pre-Enlightenment concept of history, and of course, even more different from pre-modern Chinese attitudes towards the past. And then there's a last aspect, and all the things we normally identify as modernity, rationalization, and the industrial revolution, and certain ways of organizing the economy, they are in one way or the other here mentioned under these headings. But there's another aspect of modernity that we, of course, all are aware of, but we normally don't. Well, we maybe talk about it as a side effect or as something we haven't overcome yet, but from my point of view, the other side, the other coin of modernity is as part of modernity as this side. And that's modernity as a disenchantment, a process of disenchantment and alienation. Modernity produces a breakdown of fixed transcendental frameworks of reference, of meaning. So by emphasizing history, by emphasizing the particularity of historically grown cultures, by dethroning God and in the end killing God, we have done away with frames of reference that are beyond ourselves. We have put ourselves, and with Enlightenment we have put our rational selves at the center of everything. And this leads, according to this side of modernization theory, and Max Weber is just one who reflects upon that, to a process of relativization, alienation, and the disintegration of values. And we are, of course, all aware of the consequences this has for our societies. Not to mention all sorts of negative consequences of modernity that we have been increasingly becoming aware of. I mean, environmental pollution is just one aspect of that. The unjust situation as far as income distribution is concerned is another aspect of that, but these are all things that I think are not as essential, because at least up to nowadays they're being dealt with as problems to solve with the means of modernity. But how to overcome alienation, how to overcome the disintegration of values, is something that's hitherto so far nobody really has been able to address without questioning modernity as such. Now, before I go into the critiques of progressivism, progressive views of history, I'd like to say a few words, just catch words, I don't have time for more, about the process of the reception of modern Western ideas of history in China. And I have a very crude, of course, progressive chronology, starting with Kang Youwei's New Text School that appears to be linear, three stages. But in fact, I think we have reason to doubt that, because in some of his texts we find remarks like that after the third phase, the likelihood that it goes back to phase one is very high. So there is, in his view of this three-phase, this depth development, he's very much aware that we could fall back to place zero and have to start all over again. So at least we have here the first step towards a linear, future-oriented view of history as a larger structured process. The next step is then the reception and engagement with social Darwinism, Yan Fu comes to mind, but also others, and then progressive use of history. The first one to do that in a very influential way is Liang Zhichao, but this goes on from Liang Zhichao to the May 4th generation and further. And the last step is then, and this is far before we have the Communist Party, is the reception of historical materialism, which actually starts with some KMT theoreticians who engage and who think about historical materialism and think it's a great idea, even there were, if you would do away with class struggle, which is sort of the core of it, but anyway. So we have three steps. Of the reception of Western theories of history, roughly 1890s, first decade of the 20th century, and then historic materialism, second decade of the 20th century. And then with May 4th, it branches out, and you have all sorts of theories being discussed and adapted and adopted and ignored, some of them. It's a very complex picture, but these are the three main streams we observe. Now, what's the situation these intellectuals, politicians, historians find themselves in? Situation is very complicated because reflecting on these questions of what is history, which is actually an ontological question, or on the question of how to do research on history, which is a methodological question, you're of course situated in a certain historical environment. And the environment is simply one of you have to survive. So whatever people were saying, thinking, writing, doing in this period had to be tested against the question, is this a contribution to China's survival? That's the bottom line. And whoever couldn't make the point of being important for the survival, simply somebody nobody would pay much attention to. That's something that becomes pretty clear. And it's not just a question of how to survive, it's a question of how to survive and do it fast. Because China was perceiving itself as being in a situation where extinction is just ahead next day. And extinction could mean becoming a colony like India. India was kind of the even more backward part because of the world, because it was already a colonized place. So not just making a contribution of how to survive, but how to survive fast. These were the two bottom lines everybody had to address. And then the next problem is the threat of eternal backwardness. If you buy into a theory of history that is progressive and linear and is law-like, and you have stages A, B, C, D, E, and the rest is at stage D and is reaching towards E, and you are at stage B, and it's all kind of deterministic, well, you can sit there and wait for you to be always 2 years behind. So that's not a very happy situation. You have to leap forward in great leaps, or whatever. You have to find ways to speed up so as to catch up and maybe at one point in time becoming the leader again. So pointing out how to modernize wasn't enough. You had to point out how to modernize so fast that you would actually eventually catch up with the West and restore China's dignity. But if you do that, and that's something that happened already in the early 20th century, that's not a problem of the recent 20, 25 or 40 or 50 years, that's something that already Liang Qichao in 1910 was troubled by. That is, if you catch up and if you modernize, well, you become Western. So China survived the West by becoming the West, which is, of course, a way of not surviving as a culture. So the threat to identity, at least in the perception of the intellectuals, was very, very strong. At the very beginning, 1890s, up to 1904, 5, 6, it wasn't at the heart of the discussions, but within 1910 and then in 1920s, this becomes more and more important of how can we do this in such a way that there is some link with the past, not just to be proud of, but also a substantial link to the past. Otherwise, we survive the West by becoming like the West, and that's not what we want. So in other words, what happens is that the whole world is transformed from a Chinese elite perspective from a world of cultural hierarchies with China at the center into a world of temporal hierarchies, advanced and less advanced nations, with China not at the end, but very much close to the end of the temporal hierarchy. And it's now about catching up, it's about surviving. And in that context, everybody was trying to do what appeared to be successful. And everything appeared to be successful that seemed to be working in the West. And Chinese intellectuals in the 20th century weren't often very picky about what to select from the West. As long as it appeared to be successful, be it fascism or whatever, in the 20s and 30s we have Chinese fascists or who look like fascists, and we nowadays, of course, are outraged about these people. How can you be a fascist? But when if you put yourself in China in 1930, you see a defeated China, a beaten China, a China that's not working, and you have fascist Italy and fascist Germany. Seems to be working in the early 30s, isn't it? Great successes. You start to copy that without necessarily understanding fully and subscribing fully to the ideas behind it. Some maybe did, but definitely not all of them. So in this context of everybody trying to copy and to look for solutions in the West, we don't find too many voices that become critical of these core aspects, but we do find some voices. And the first critique is a critique motivated by moral concerns. Because very early on, Du Yaqun in the 1910s, Liang Qichao after 1919, after World War I, and Liu Yuzhong in the early 20s after May 4th, we have quite a few influential intellectuals who say, well, there might be progress on the material side, technical side, but if we look at ethics, I don't see progress, I see the opposite of it. Or at least I see a mixed picture of progress and regress. We see a mixed picture of improvements and moral failure. So yes, progress might be there, but only in certain areas, certain parts of human life, important parts of human life, like the ethical constitution of society, they cannot assume a progressive history. So that's one very widespread critique of progressivism that, of course, is very limited. A second form of critique of progressivism is out of concerns of national identity. As I just mentioned, if you take the West and the Western success and the Western progress as the model to follow, well, sooner or later you have to ask yourself, what's Chinese about yourself? And then you have the signification of whatever. You can add whatever you want to that. So the emphasis on national particularity can be interpreted as nothing but a psychological trick to make yourself feel better, but I think it goes far beyond that, as I will try to show in the course of this presentation. And examples that come to mind here are, of course, Maoist signification of Marxism, also the field of history, where Maoist ideas about history are quite different from those of Marx, Lenin, or Stalin. But both these critiques are not doubting progressive history as such. They either want to limit it or to safeguard certain parts of social human life as not under the control of progressive history, or they want to slightly adjust it. There's a third, more fundamental critique of progressivism that's motivated by doubts about the nature of modernity, that touches upon core aspects of the modern condition, that is, a specific view of history, a specific view of human agency and ethics. And I will today talk about two intellectuals, Zhang Kaiyan, oh, I have Zhang Biling behind me, never mind, and Liu Yizhang. Zhang Kaiyan is actually quite famous, but the ideas I will present here today are those who were not famous and did not have a big impact. So I'm focusing on the marginal part, the not so popular part of Zhang Kaiyan. And Liu Yizhang was actually extremely unfamous. In other words, he didn't exert any influence in the 1930s, 1940s. He wrote a book, Zhongguo Wenhua Shi, History of Chinese Culture, that became a textbook in post-war Taiwan. But even there, never really was able to compete with Qian Mo's Guo Shibagang. Nobody on the mainland knew the guy until 10 years ago. And even nowadays, if you go to history departments in the PRC and you ask 100 students, two or three might have heard his name. He's not very famous. And the part of Zhang Kaiyan I will present here today is also not the really influential, famous part. Both these intellectuals are neither traditional. None of them wants to go back to whatever tradition, nor are they simply anti-Western, in the sense that they argued against modernity because this modernity was of Western origins and threatens Chineseness. They put a lot of emphasis in their presentation, in their ideas on particularity, you might call that national identity, so it plays a role in their argumentation, an important role, but not as a marker of identity. Particularity is not a marker of identity, but it is brought up in the context of attempts to overcome alienation as a central problematic of modernity. They want to overcome the alienation between a particular historical manifestation, individual life, and the bigger, let's say, if questions of a cosmic structure, of a historical process, of a transcendent Tao, whatever they refer to. They want to bring these two things together again in a Chinese future. Now let me say a few words about Zhang Kaiyan, right here is Zhang Bingling. Well, Zhang Kaiyan is an extremely complicated personality, multifaceted, all the time changing, happy to contradict himself. It's nearly impossible to say one thing about him that's not wrong and right at this same point in time, because he does so many different things. So I'm not trying to do justice to him. I will just focus on the aspects that I can kind of make use of for my own intellectual inquiry. This is his 1904-5-6-7 critique of modern views of history and the modern world order, which is inspired by Buddhism and also by Taoism. Zhang is To be sure, you all know him, somebody who has very strong nationalistic feelings. He argues in the decade before the Xinhai Revolution for a new state, a Chinese state. He wants to overthrow the Qing and establish, and actually the term Guangfu would be better for his concepts than Goming. He wants to restore the Ming, not the Ming as that dynasty, but the idea of a Han dynasty. So he argues for a state, a new state, a Chinese state, to overthrow the Qing, but in the end, he negates the self, the state, and history altogether, which is a very peculiar outcome for a revolutionary who wants to overthrow the state and build a new one. So how does he do that? Well, initially, he the first step, he explains time, history, self, and state with the help of Yogacara theories, concepts of consciousness. So he says that the karmic seeds, yezhong, which are the results of past actions, are stored in the so-called storehouse consciousness, alaya shi, alaya vijnana. And these results, these outcomes of past actions that are stored in the storehouse consciousness, they are being misrecognized. And that's another level of the consciousness theory of Yogacara Buddhism. They're being misrecognized by obscuration consciousness, by manas vijnana, as the self, as a stable, constant, fixed self. So we have self-consciousness arising out of a misrecognition of these karmic seeds in storehouse consciousness. And when this self-consciousness now arises and then gets in touch, in contact with mano-vijnana, that is cognition, sense center consciousness, then it creates the feeling of time, because now you have a fixed self that compares itself vis-a-vis events that appear to be in time, moving on, differing. And that creates the feeling of time, which then is at the base of a feeling of history. So Jante, in quoting these vijnana theories, says when the mind, when the self-consciousness arises, there is time. When the mind is quiet, then there is no time. So it is the misrecognition of karmic seeds as the self that leads to an experience of time. And that's also then is used to help to explain what history is. Because history is, we have karmic seeds that are stored in the storehouse consciousness. They are then brought to fruition against reaction and producing karmic fruits, yeguo, that again become karmic seeds for the next round of actions. And that's then, of course, the well-known Buddhist theory of samsara. So history is explained not as a directional linear process, but as a development of seeds and fruits becoming seeds again, producing ever new actions and karmic consequences. And when the self arises in this process of misrecognition, subject and object are separated, alienation sets in, and the state in Jantayan's theory is nothing but a larger collective self. It's a big misrecognition. Now, when you subscribe to this idea of history, explaining it as a karmic process, which is not progressive, to be sure. It's not something you can causally predict. With this concept of history, particularity, what you observe here now is understood as causation, something that has been brought about by a complicated mixture of interplay of karmic seeds, circumstances, human action, and this all together leads to the current situation. That means it is not predictable, and there are no universal laws at work that you can use to calculate what will happen next. That's not possible. History, understood as a karmic evolution, is a process that is morally bidirectional. In other words, there is no moral improvement underway. This very much depends on the nature of your karmic deeds, karmic actions. So before the Xinhai Goming, before the revolution of 1911, Zhang Taiyuan uses this Yogacara theory of history and of self and of the state in order to argue for the creation of a Chinese state to fight against the Qing and imperialism. And he combines that with a call for a racially grounded revolution, which, as I just mentioned, is more of a restoration than a revolution. But then he goes a crucial step further, because he exposes these ideas. In the old theory is based on the assumption that self arises out of a misrecognition of karmic seeds as being the self. Now, once you emphasize that point, then the self and the state and history are deconstructed as the results of delusion, as the consequence of the misrecognition of the storehouse consciousness as the self. And once that is overcome, and the mind is then quiet, the self dissolves, the karmic process comes to a halt, and history ends not in a state of liberal bliss after the end of the Cold War, but history ends in a state of suchness, genru, which is not self-realization, but self-negation. This is then, in the second step, a fundamental critique of history as such. It's not a critique of progressive history, a specific variant of history, it's actually a denial there's something like history. There's a karmic process, but it's not history. And it's, to be sure, it's a delusion. So in that second period, Zhang Taiyuan, which really doesn't surprise us anymore at the point we know a bit about Buddhist theory of consciousness, he remains pretty silent on issues of social, political, and economic organization. He doesn't go to these very pressing issues of China in 1910, 1911. He supports claims to equality of nations with the help of Taoist concepts that are of the Qiulun. So things are equal because they are different. They are equal in their difference. Arguments like that are being brought forward also to protect kind of Chinese particularity. But he refrains from drawing up any kind of a blueprint for the future of China. It's a very radical critique of history and actually of society and politics. And of course, it doesn't really surprise anybody here, I guess, that historians didn't really pay attention to that theory because it would have made them obsolete. It could have stopped working the next day. But still, Zhang Taiyuan is a figure that had quite an impact. Because after he published these ideas were around. They didn't exert an influence on politics, they didn't exert an influence on the May 4th movement and the intellectuals in that framework, but you will hardly find any a modern Chinese philosopher who in one way or the other doesn't go back to these ideas and refer to them or is inspired by the consequences of these ideas. Now, the second person I'd like to go to introduce shortly is Liu Yizhen. Here I have to say a little bit more because he's so utterly unknown. Has anybody heard his name before here? Just as a question? No. Well, that's always... it's interesting because he is the author who published the first History of Chinese Culture ever. And this was a bestseller in the 1920s, 1930s. It was such a bestseller that it was copied before it was even on the market, pirated. So he had to publish it in a serialized version in the Xuan Journal in order to make some money. He had an impact, but then somehow the field of cultural history was occupied by Qianmu, and he was more influential in the end. So Liu Yizhen is one of those historians who, in the early period of the 20th century, the first decade, belongs to the generation who really wholeheartedly accepts and adopts Western progressive history. He is one of those who translates Japanese histories of China into Chinese. And of course, those Japanese histories of China that are written along the lines of Western progressive history. So he considers history to be causal, linear, focusing on the nation state. He adopts Western models of periodization, antiquity, medieval ages, modern period, so a clear temporal hierarchy. He shifts his view of history from cultural or civilizational heroes to the people, the masses. Renmin at the time was not yet a term used by the leftists, but it's what he was actually using the term at that period without any further, let's say, left-right implications. But basically, Renmin meant well, sovereignty, popular sovereignty. That's what Renmin stood for in this period of China's history. So it's nothing surprising here. In the next step, and this is roughly the second decade of the 20th century, he becomes a professor. At Southeastern University in Nanjing, professor of history, and here he starts to lecture on cultural history, which then eventually leads to the publication of Zhongguo Wanhua Shi in the early 20s. It's still a linear causal history, but more emphasis on national particularity, on Chinese culture, than the first decade, but not yet leading to a major revision of his view of history and his methodology of doing research on history. And then, in the third period, he starts to doubt progressive history and starts to criticize the new culture movement. He first limits progress to the material field and emphasizes that ethics isn't part of that, it's separate. So there is no progress in the moral quality of human beings. That's something we have to work on. It's in our hands, it's not part of an historical process. And then in mid-20s, he more and more really comes out as a opponent of the May 4th movement. A major figure writing in the Critical Review journal, the Xuehan Zhaji, and now openly attacking teleological understandings of progress. He does that by writing book reviews on academic publications that rewrite the history of Chinese philosophy, the history of Chinese religion, the history of Chinese law, along the lines of a progressive view of history using Western concepts. And he does that by interestingly going back to the I Ching, concepts like Hengbi and Yin Yang, and saying, well, when we read these books, when we read the I Ching, we can see there is no progress in change. Change is not progressive, which is just a claim at that point in time. He again talks then about morality and how this doesn't necessarily progress. He uses, this time he still uses concepts like contingency or Ranxing, which are clearly Western terms. Later he drops them because they're too Western. And he explicitly refutes causality. So he starts to attack all the core elements of a modern progressive view of history. But this still is within the confines of 20, 15 pages book reviews, not a fully developed new approach to history. And that he had to work another 20 years, and then in 1948, a few years before he died, he published a book called Essentials of the History of the Guo. I'm not convinced I should translate this as national history, but we could, of course. Guo Shi Yao Yi. And now here, the last step, he comes up with what I called here a new, in quotation marks, a new view of history that is a more cultural view of history and writing history that is firmly grounded in the Confucian historiographical tradition while implementing some changes. How does he do that? Now, he, after in the 20s, writing reviews saying there is no progress. If you look at the I Ching, you can see there is no progressive development. He now starts to say what there is. And he claims there is, these are all now, I mean, commonplaces in Confucian philosophy. There is a heavenly order. He uses various terms for that, traditional terms, but also modern terms. Tianxing or Tianxu are very often terms he uses for that. There is a heavenly order, and human nature has its roots in that heavenly order. So Renxing is directly deriving from the nature of heaven. And the human relations, Renlun, are then next steps towards implementing that human nature. At the same time, he also spends quite a lot of time on showing how the concrete, actual historical manifestations of that heavenly order, of that human nature, are always particular. So he always talks about Li Shi, the Tezhu Xing, about the particularity of history. He uses terms like Min Xing, Min Zu Xing, or Xi Xing, to show that what we can observe in history is never directly human nature or the heavenly order, but particular manifestations of that. And that's an argument he uses, the next step, to protect China against Western claims of universal dominance. What you do there is just a particular Western style of organizing society or organizing life. We have our own ways, but both are different manifestations of a shared universal heavenly order and human nature. And now in a methodological reflection, he uses this idea of this hierarchy of of orders from universal to particular, to provide a ground for a methodology of historical research, because we as human beings, we partake in that human nature. And if we do that right, if we do that well, if we are well trained in that, and only then are we able to look at people from other historical eras or other cultures. Because it's only through that shared human nature can we get access to what people did in the past. Otherwise, it's foreign, it's strange, it's the other, we can't really deal with it. So that's a pretty staggering consequence of that. He then says, everybody wants to be a historian. Well, professional training in reading sources is one thing, that's clear, but you need a very long training in moral philosophy. You need to be a trained philosopher, you need to understand what human nature is. And only when you have reached that through long processes of meditation can you work as a historian. Otherwise, you will see just the outside and won't get to the heart of it. So history for him is this part of, let's say, the record of humanity through which, with the right preparation, you can get a view of the human nature, not through meditation, but through research. Meditation and moral training is a prerequisite for doing that, but then you have to actualize that in historical research. You have to find out how the past or how other cultures in their specific particular way are also a manifestation of the human nature and of the heavenly order. And of course goes against the very core of what is modern professional historical research. I mean, if you would make moral training part of our historical curricula, well, you can imagine what historians will do. They will yell at you. That's exactly the opposite of what we think research should be. So he denies progress, and he actually doesn't have a concept of history in the modern sense of that word. There is no impersonal, unified process going on beyond our control that's leading to some sort of telos. It's just not there. And he emphasizes cultural particularity as the basis for equality and mutual respect. But of course, we can feel how proud he is that Chinese civilization and Confucian view of heavenly order and human nature provides a solution to the problems of modern historical methodology and modern views of history. So he doesn't hide his pride here. And we also find at times pretty condescending remarks about how the West got it all wrong. So the emphasis on mutual respect and because of particularity is kind of mixed with a few other remarks. And all of this is done while at the same time he's publishing texts about how important it is for China to learn from the West. Well, this is not a diehard conservative. He emphasizes the rule of law. He emphasizes sovereignty. Sovereignty lies in the people. This is where we have to put the political power. The nation is the appropriate form of organization, at least right now. So he's not a Confucian, whatever that, traditional Confucian, whatever that might mean. He's somebody who tries to come up with a view of history and combine it with modern forms of social and political organization. Of course, when reading these texts, I'm pretty unsatisfied by his solution because I don't see it being a solution. I have the same feelings when I'm reading Jiang Qing nowadays and his ideas about three chambers in the parliament. But well, they're trying their best and that's what they come up with right now, and he definitely is not somebody who just skip these important aspects and engages with them. Now coming to the last part of my presentation. Now, both are marginal. They exert little, if not even no influence. Well, I think there are two reasons for that. One is the sheer force of the success of modernization. If you, as I said at the beginning, if you present a theory of history of the organization of society in this period, and you're not able to tell the reader, and if you follow my blueprint, you can rescue China, then you just don't get an audience. That's something you've got to do, and if you don't do this, there's no audience. And they didn't do it. Or the way they did it didn't convince anybody. So this is the first problem that Zhang Taiying, with his most radical denial of history, of course, had to somehow remain silent, and Liu Yizhong kind of used Confucian concepts and combined them with Western concepts, but didn't really make clear how the idea of the rule of law can be combined with a notion of, and also the notion of popular sovereignty can be combined with the notion of a heavenly, of a heavenly order. That's something you have to explain. It's not unexplainable, but it has to be explained, and he didn't go into these details. So the next thing is that if you, and as I tried to show at the beginning, I think there is a systematic link between what we call modernity and progressive views of history and abstract notions of abstract time. And if you go against these core notions of modernity, it's very hard to convince people that you can still modernize and yet avoid these problems and avoid these negative consequences. At least you have to make an attempt to explain that they didn't. They argued against progressive history, they argued against abstract time, they argued against some negative aspects, especially the moral field of modernity, but they didn't talk about the connection between history and time here and the modern condition there. And this, which is why I think they weren't able to convince people that they have a solution. Both are nevertheless interesting cases of a fundamental critique of modernity. Why interesting? Because both try, and from my point of view, somehow failed to make use of traditional ideas with some new ideas to provide a solution. That's interesting not because of its failure, but because of how this is being addressed nowadays again and how this failure worked out. Because I think both were, in a way, avant-garde. They were avant, because it was a trenchant critique of the dark side of modernity. People like Jean Taillon and Yuri Gerson were very much aware of the consequences for our understanding of human agency, of ethics, of the position of mankind in a cosmic structure, a cosmic process that came with the new concept of modernity, and they didn't subscribe to it, and they argued against it. It was a trenchant critique of the dark side of modernity, of problems like alienation, disenchantment, decentering the world, and of disempowerment of human beings. At the same time, they were a guard, because they wanted to protect mankind against modernity, or in your case, reinstall a more human agent. So they thought about problems that are, I think, still nowadays more important than they have been for a long, long time, in the last 15, 20 years after the end of the Cold War, and especially after the end of the dreams that came with the end of the Cold War. We are at a point where questions of this sort have to be and are being asked again, and not just here, but also in China. Now, I think this is why both nowadays, in the context of the revival of interest in Chinese traditions, both of them are being paid attention to again. Of course, again, still nowadays marginal. You find hundreds of books about Hou Shi, and thousands of books about Liang Zhichao, and many books about Wang Guowei and Chen Yunqiu and other cultural heroes. Not so many books about Zhang Taiyuan, he is so difficult, and very, very few books about Liu Yizhen. But still, in comparison to 25 years ago, you found people who know Liu Yizhen, and 25 years ago there was nobody who knew who that person was. And nowadays you find people paying attention to those aspects of Zhang Taiyuan that I referred to here, and 30 years ago it was more about his ideas about revolution and the Han race and so on and so forth. So they're being discussed again today. And we observe, as I said in the beginning, the rise of spiritual cults and movements in China today that, and this is my question at the end, it's really just a question. The question is whether this new interest in these people and whether the rise of these cults and new movements, whether they're just en vogue because they are Chinese. Well, we have that, and of course that's definitely a factor in the return of rise of these new movements, new cults, or of interest in these intellectuals, or whether there's a deeper concern with problems, maybe not of modernity, that's a very abstract word, but concern with problems of modern life. So if we look at these intellectuals, and if we at the same time then look at the return and rise of these religious and spiritual traditions in contemporary China, I think we can make use not of their answers, but of their questions they're trying to answer, to make sense of that beyond the issues that are important too, of identity, politics, and social organization. Thank you.